E-commerce Gold is brought to you by Rewind. Accidents happen. Maybe you installed an app and it messed up your theme, or a store collaborator deleted product images by mistake. It's a common myth that Shopify has a backup that you can use when something goes wrong with your store. The fact is they don't. That's untrue. That myth is busted. So what do? You use Rewind to equip your Shopify store with automated backups. Rewind should be the first app you install to protect your store against human error, misbehaving apps, or collaborators gone bad. It's like having your very own magic undo button. It's trusted by over 100,000 businesses, from side hustles to the biggest online retailers like NYX, Lord & Taylor, and Moomin. It's even a Shopify Plus certified app. Best of all, visit rewind.com/ecommercegold and get your first month for absolutely nothing, free on us. The Ecom Gold podcast has partnered with ClearCo to provide you with financial tools to grow your business without having to give away equity. ClearCo is the world's largest e-commerce investor and growth platform, giving founders the financial tools, capital, and network they need to grow. Plug in your Shopify store and your loan could be agreed within just 24 hours. Visit clear.co/partner/vixxr for exclusive deals, £1,000 off your first loan as a podcast listener, and more information. This show is brought to you in collaboration with Vixxr, a leading Shopify agency with a mission to grow and migrate brands to Shopify Plus. They've worked with some of the world's largest brands and can help you level up your e-commerce performance. Visit vixxr.com, V-I-X-X-R.com for more information. What a fantastic episode this is. We speak to Eli, the king of customer experience, and he shares with us his strategies, insights, knowledge, and learning of his experience with customer experience and how he's applying that at the company he currently works for, which is Jones Road Beauty, a company which is founded by Bobby Brown. We get into it in this episode. I really hope you find value and there's some things you can implement in your business. This is a bit of a masterclass, and I would really appreciate it if you could take the time after this episode just to subscribe if you haven't already. Maybe give the episode a share. So without further ado, here we go. I put you in the top 1% of people on planet Earth with the knowledge and skills that you have and experience and network. So it's just interesting to me that you choose to be employed. And I say that with respect, because I think you could very easily start your own companies. Is that something that you have played with yourself? Are you, what's the kind of theory behind you enjoying what you do right now, and why do you do it in the way that you
I absolutely love this question, Finn. First of all, thank you for the kindness. I think it's really, really sweet of you. I think that a few things. So I started a company in 2014. My brain is kind of so jello. I don't even recall exactly when, but I started a company that failed. And the reason why it failed is because I was very ambitious and excited, but I didn't really have enough, actually like real life, training of what I call, like, you know, the world training of the world, like knowing what works, what doesn't. I've learned that, you know, when people spend 5, 10, 15 years in college, like, I'm learning that in the real world by working with really incredible people. And I've just seen what I was able to learn being at a fast growing company versus doing it myself. And there is most definitely going to be a time and place where I go out on my own again. I've been lucky enough to do a tiny bit of consulting on the side that's really filling that side of my brain where I, you know, get to jump into somebody's company and spend 2 hours on a weekend and figure it out. For now, my biggest priority is finding companies that are on this massive growth trajectory and being able to learn and get paid doing it with somebody else's company, right? Like, can I prove that I can build someone else's company? And I'm not like a, you know, for somebody that works in startups, I'm not a massive risk taker. I guess my wife would think otherwise based on all the Peloton stock I bought, but I'm not like a massive risk taker, and I've done it and it wasn't massively successful. And I've decided I'll take a couple of years building it. And it, to be completely frank, and I say this in a very humble way, like, I didn't expect I'd be where I am now 5 years ago. I'm doing better than I thought I would, given the luck I've had. I think that I've been really lucky to meet the right people. Like, all my last three roles are through Twitter. Like, I've had the opportunity to share things that I'm genuinely excited about and had people that were gravitated towards it and that gave me opportunity. I think over the last 2 years, but it's pretty crazy, Finn, that in 2020, I couldn't find a job. In the last 2 years, I've been offered jobs at some of the coolest D2C brands. And it's really kind of changed the way I thought about a job. And I think when you talk about, being employed, like, I'm obviously not in a place where I want to like be told what to do every hour of every day. And I want the creative ability to build something special. And that's been the biggest non-negotiable for me in talking to when I joined Olipop. My first interview was like, I have these crazy ideas and I want to be in a place that lets me unleash them. And with Jones Road, it was the same thing, right? Like working with Bobby Brown, who's been, in the industry for 25 years and built a $1 billion brand. She's doing this again. And working with Cody, who's her son, who's also like an absolute genius. And it's like, can I do these things differently? And that's been my biggest thing.
Wait, what, Cody, as in your, I don't want to say your Twitter BFF, but that's certainly how it feels.
Yeah.
That's Bobby Brown's son.
Right. Different last name. So you don't get it. Undercover.
Whoa.
I didn't know that until I met him either. But I mean, Cody is just an absolute legend. I mean, he thinks about growth differently than most growth marketers I've met. And that's like the biggest reason why I took this job, right? Like, I'm a dude that never wore makeup. I took the job at Jones because I absolutely love the way Cody thinks about marketing, the way Bobby thinks about brand and product. And this feels like fun. Like, the fact that I get paid to do it as well is crazy to me, but it feels like fun. I'm very young. People start very successful companies in their 30s and 40s. And I keep saying this, but I have a 30-year plan. Like, most people have a 5-year plan where they want to be. I don't have that. Like, I'm vibing. My wife's in med school and we have a kid that's almost a year old, and I have time, right? Like, if I start a company in 5 or 10 years, that'll be awesome. If I start consulting and doing that kind of stuff in 5, 10 years, it's awesome too. And right now I'm just having such a blast working with people I only dreamed of working with 5 years ago. And I pinch myself, but it's been exciting.
Yeah. And but also from what I've seen, what I understand just through the content that you share, you're super talented in the space. So
thank you.
They all, and they're talented enough to recognize that. So they give you that freedom. I'm obviously, this is, I don't know this. I'm not in your office, but I can tell by the interactions, the way that you guys communicate on Twitter, you just have this fun, energetic feel. I get that from Cody. I get that from you.
We call it banter.
Yeah.
In the UK.
But it's like, it works. And you guys obviously have the freedom to try things, do things, and you believe in what you are doing. And I think that's just such a great company culture to have. And I've seen the flip opposite of that, where it's like a 4-gray wall office and everyone, doesn't even speak and they have their lunch on their own facing a wall. And it's just like, oh, everything's done by spreadsheets. There's no risk whatsoever. There's no fun whatsoever. And
I'm sweating as you describe that.
Yeah, right. But can be successful, but it's like, where would you? You only have one life, right? So you've got to enjoy it. But I love the fact that you're just picking up all of these experience points, making those connections, and obviously investing in yourself as well on Twitter. Like, your future is going to be, from anyone's perspective, going to be crazy. And obviously your wife's in med school as well.
Too kind. Way too kind.
That's just wild. Anyway, after all of that, CX is what you're known for. And my experience with clients that we've had, CX has often been an afterthought in the traditional sense, that it is a part of the business that is a necessity, but not a part of the business that is discussed and focused on. And that's sad, really, for a number of reasons. And there's obviously value that can be attributed to CX. So can you just treat me like a startup, high growth founder with a business who has no idea about CX, and just teach me some stuff about CX? Give me the basics, give me some tips, however you want to go, however you want to do it. And I've got some other questions here that I can fire at you as you go.
Yeah, I love it. I think that there's, you know, let's take a step back. Customer service has always been viewed as a call center. And the reason why it is that way is because it's always been reactive, right? It's like a customer purchases something from the brand, they purchase software, whatever it is. When they have a problem, they go to customer support. Customer support resolves the problem and then they move on with their life. And the reason why brands have hesitated to go towards this like customer experience kind of revitalized vision around what support looks like is because it's expensive. It costs money. You know, like you can't outsource it for $2 an hour. What we've seen, you know, since the 90s is that SaaS companies have transitioned to this customer success model where people get paid six figures to basically make sure that they, that their customers are happy and that they can upsell them and get them into renewals and view it as a more proactive way. But SaaS companies have focused on it. CPG brands haven't. As like the Facebook dial started turning and, you know, iOS 15 and all that has transitioned over the last couple of years, brands are realizing that waiting until customers leave and then hiring a retention team to bring those people back is very costly and ineffective and silly. And what we realize is that, you know, we as a collective, CPG universe have noticed that when you proactively invest time, resources, money into making sure that people have a great experience or at least have an experience that they expected, you don't have to chase after them once they leave. What that looks like on a very practical level is the difference between like a customer support, you know, out of the customer support storybook is that they just handle issues as they come in. What I view customer experience as, and it's why my role is customer experience and retention, is because I think that when you look throughout the customer journey and you can make sure that we're at least meeting expectations, most brands aim to exceed them, at least meet expectations across the journey, that gives us a much better chance for customers to come back. What that looks like on a more granular level is the Facebook ads that you're running, are they selling some crazy product that doesn't exist? And then they get it thinking like, oh, this looks like it came from wish.com. Or are you selling the actual product? Your site experience, is it cohesive? Does it make sense for customers? Is it this journey that customers are going on? Or is it just like you're throwing a bunch of things, they work, and then the second the customer gets it, they're like, what the fuck is this? And that's really like the job of a great customer experience team is to understand A, which data is important. Like just getting data is not helpful because now I have a whole bunch of spreadsheets of data is not helpful. So understanding which data is actionable and useful, and B, making sure you get it to the right place, right? Like if I get a whole bunch of data around why customers dislike the product, but I don't do anything about it, that's silly. Now, let me give you a very, very straightforward example of how that happens. One of our best-selling SKUs is a Miracle Balm. It's in most orders. Customers love it. I've gone through thousands of NPS scores and looked at qualitative feedback from customers. And one of the biggest reasons, if somebody is not to like it, one of the biggest reasons, the three biggest reasons that I've synthesized over the last 2 months are it, you know, it doesn't work with my oily skin, it's too sticky, or it's too tacky, right? Those three issues, we can actually know if a customer has oily skin because most customers take our survey before they purchase. So we have zero-party data saying like, hey, I have oily skin. Now, what if we took that data and we said, post-purchase, your email, if you have oily skin, is going to be dramatically different. We'll tell you to use a lot less. And when you see the videos of Bobbi Brown using it, she has dry skin. So she puts a lot, you put a whole lot less. So now we transitioned your entire customer journey based on customer feedback that can be the most dramatic retention play we've done ever, right? Like now everyone that buys the product loves it because they're using it the correct way, right? So that's a very, very practical example how a proactive customer experience approach integrated with retention, the rest of marketing can actually, hopefully, fingers crossed, transform a business.
Experience is such a key word in what you're saying there because customer support, customer experience. I feel like the old world is customer support, where you have your support team stuffed next to your warehouse, fielding calls from people who are pissed off with some of the things you mentioned, marketing, overselling the product, or logistics, not getting the products on time. And they're just fighting fires. Usually kids straight out of school, college with a script. And, you know, that's just hellish, right? And what you do is customer experience, which is something that is much more integrated by based on what you said along that complete customer journey. So where does it start? So if we look at the customer journey as the first step being awareness, engagement, you know, and all the way through to purchase, post-purchase, where do you actually begin on the customer journey? And what does that first step look like? Is it after the purchase? Are you actually involved before the purchase? Like, where do you sit on the customer journey?
Yeah, that's a great question. And honestly, when I was at Olipop, we would work with the team on captions for ads. We'd look at the ad copy. Is this, you know, like we had a story at Olipop where we had an ad that did really well. It was a gorgeous pour shot. It was soda over ice, and it looked like all the cues from a Coke ad. And it did really, really well on the acquisition side. Like the CAC was super low, but we ended up realizing that the LTV from these customers that came through that cohort weren't great. And my hypothesis was that people that joined through that ad had this expectation of this product being 10 times as good as a Coke because it looks the same and it costs 10 times the price or 5 times the price. When they get the product and they're like, oh, this is not that great. This is nothing special. But they had no interaction with the benefits of the brand and the benefits of the product versus when we take an approach of doing us versus them with here's the difference between us and a Coke and we're selling the benefits and we're selling why this is so much more expensive. Those customers, the acquisition might be higher, but the retention's better. Now, as a brand, like, should you focus on low CAC, high LTV versus, you know, the opposite? I guess depends what brand you're trying to build. For us, we are focused on, you know, both at Olipop and at Jones Road, we're focused on brand, right? We want people to have a great experience. Even if we get a whole bunch of customers come in once, we'd rather have less customers come multiple times. So it's important to really, really integrate customer experience, you know, like the feedback that we're learning from customers, back sending that back to the ads. What that looks like by us is like, we have our, you know, our growth team looking at all the NPS data and learning from positive engagement, positive feedback and negative feedback from customers. Like, what are the objections that we're trying to answer with this ad? What are the pieces of great stuff that we should be mentioning to get in front of customers? So I think there's a ton of like this really tight feedback loop is what my objective is. Like, how can I pull the rest of the team into it? If we have a quality issue, if we have an ops issue, if we have issues with the 3PL, like all this data is coming in and most brands end up spending, you know, $50,000 to bring in a team of experts to tell them what their customers are saying. And we have that all in front of us. The job of a great CX team is synthesizing that data and making it cohesive. Because if I send a 30-page slide deck to the entire team and say, like, here's your data, nobody will get it. Nobody will look through the whole thing. If I say, like, here are the three things that you should, you know, like, here, we just launched a new product. It's called WTF, What the Foundation. If you have 3 minutes, these are the four qualitative things that we should focus on. Like, these are the reasons why people hate it. These are the reasons why people love it. And then we can tackle that as a team.
So there's definitely a difference between, there's a skill set, right? And I'm going to ask you in a second for a framework, if you have one, because you have it naturally. I know you will have this naturally, but there's a difference between listening to a customer complaint or customer feedback and hearing a customer complaint and customer feedback. And I can imagine that when you're taking that data straight to your ear from a customer, you're hearing them and you're thinking through, why did this situation occur? More than just, oh God, let's ship them an alternative product or give them store credit, or more than just the rational answer to the problem. You're thinking backwards of, okay, this is where we are. How did we get here? What do we need to do to resolve that? That comes naturally to you, I bet, right? But it probably doesn't come naturally to everyone, probably not even me. So is there a framework? If I was joining your team and I'm super junior, like, how would you get me in that mindset? What am I thinking about?
Wow, that's a good question. Two things. So I think the number one thing that's important in any CX team or in any marketing team, I guess more broadly, is there's so much noise, right? Like, there's noise from customers, there's noise from internal team, and deciphering signal versus noise is really difficult. What I see in any CX team is, like, within the first 20 minutes of an issue coming up, it'll look like you've been hit 20 times, right? Like, you'll be like, there are 10 tickets about the same thing. Like, shit's falling down, right? And it takes a more, you know, a more tempered approach to look at the data and say, like, well, we've sold 20,000 of these items. We have 10 complaints. In the scheme of things, it's nothing too crazy. Let's continue listening and let's see what we have at the end of the day, right? So there's, like, dealing with issues versus understanding what is signal versus noise that you should pass along. And I think for me, it feels like it's come from being in this shitstorm for a bunch of years that you end up realizing like what feels like a testy customer versus like what is a real issue. I really appreciate the challenge of like, how do I give that to somebody with zero experience that comes in and says like, how do I do it? And as I'm thinking through it, it feels like the most powerful part of this is understanding what is somebody's own personal experience versus facts. And both can be true. Like this can be the worst experience somebody had as a consumer, but on a factual level, it's not something that is the worst thing we've ever seen. For example, if somebody gets their product and it's the box is bashed up, they might have very high standards where they're really, really pissed off. And granted, maybe in this case, even though it's not our fault, we should give them a refund and reship it or whatever we do to go above and beyond. At the same time, in the scheme of things, it's not the craziest thing we've ever seen. So I think being, you know, taking everything with a grain of salt and not really getting swayed by, you know, I can sense from the tone in the email that this customer is super, super frustrated, but it doesn't mean we should, you know, start getting all the alarms blaring. And that's like, I think the biggest thing that I've learned over the last couple of years is understanding that we have to, like, as emotional, empathetic people, we have to lean into that, but we also have to lean back on data to a certain extent, right? Where it's like, this sounds like it's the worst thing in the world, but is it? And that's something I ask myself very often is like, okay, but can we see the data on it? And I hate spreadsheets and I'm terrible at math, but you know, when you get to a certain place where you're like, okay, like we can find a calculator and figure out how many of the, we tagged all these issues. We know how many issues there are. We know how many products we've sold. Like in the scheme of things, it's not such a large issue. And then the other thing I think is important and pretty difficult is like, what is an issue that I should be passing along? And the way I think about that as far as frameworks is it's one of a few things. Number one, is it an issue that can potentially be related to product, right? Like that's always a big one because if that's an issue, we want to flag it as early as we can, even if it seems to be only a few customers because we want to be able to track that. Number two, if it feels like an issue that can easily be resolved and it can't be resolved by us. So a lot of times teams just pass it along when we can easily resolve it. But if there's like the warehouse is making multiple mistakes that are the same and it doesn't seem like 100% a human error, can we tell them that this pack out is incorrect and they should fix it? Feels easy enough. And then the third thing is something that we can share and other people can learn from, right? Where it's like, if I can, this is the way this customer was handled and it worked really well. Like they came in guns blazing. They said they'll never purchase again. And we went above and beyond. And now this customer is fully, fully obsessed with us. So those are like the, I guess, the three things that I'm looking at in terms of what should I be sharing.
And with the current climate and the predicted future climate in the shorter term for e-commerce is that the audiences are going to become less inclined to spend. They're going to have less capital, disposable capital to spend. It's obviously harder to target people. So not only your core customers, but actually some of your fringe customers who aren't your best customers become really, really important, especially in that piece around retention that you mentioned. And how do you, and I'm talking maybe when you're talking to your heads of departments or your colleagues who are heading up other departments, how do you balance losing a customer? Because like you said, you have some data, you have, so I've got an example, right? I'll name no names, but a protein company that I've used for a while. I was on a subscription, shipped me my protein. It's not my protein. They just shipped me my protein. The bag split on one of the shipments and the company of it, Royal Mail in the UK, had to literally deliver it in a bin bag because the powder had gone everywhere. So fair enough, you know, things happen. Dropped them an email. You know, I'm a core customer. I make two or three orders a month. And I said, hey guys, this is what's happened. You know, I was chill about it because it wasn't their fault. I was like, this is what's happened. I sent them some pictures. Fine, we'll ship you one out straight away. I'm like, brilliant. Thank you very much. A month later, nothing. Haven't heard from them. Contacted them again. Oh, sorry, it didn't get actioned. We'll ship it now. And it still hasn't turned up. So they've lost me as a customer, right? I'm not going to give you one chance, but two or three, and it's kind of too much. And I've gone elsewhere, and that's fine. But that could have been dealt with in a different way. And I was probably an expensive customer to acquire because there's so many options and You know, I've got to try the product, and then I've then got to ramp up my spend and get all of the additional products like the multivitamins to go with it. And, you know, my order was quite sizable by the end of that. And that's a lot of investment from the brand to get me to that core customer status. And then they lost me just because of something silly. You know, they didn't process something, or there wasn't a system in place to catch that. So like, how do you, I guess the question is, to summarize, how do you work out, okay, is this a customer that we can afford to lose? Can we afford to lose any customers? Because obviously the simple answer would have been just to ship me a product straight away and maybe chuck something else in the box, but that's going to kill your margins, right? So from my perspective as a consumer, I'm like, oh, they should just ship something straight away and make me really happy. But so what's the balance there? What's actually happening internally? What's the discussion? What's going on?
Yeah, I mean, this is like, the question resonates with me for a few reasons. I think that what you see pretty often is the people you're talking to don't have any invested interest to resolve your issue, right? Which is like the people that are you're in touch with are getting paid peanuts, don't know anything about you as a customer, don't care, because they get their paycheck whether or not you stick around or don't stick around, right? There's no interconnection between growth and retention. And there's nobody gives a shit, right? That's the biggest problem. Number two, they don't have the ability to go above and beyond and fix it, because for them to add something extra into your box is going to make them have to call three people to get approval. Is that worth it? Probably not. What do they gain? You know, and third is like, what do they gain if you stick around? Nothing, right? So that's like the most important thing to just like set the scene. Like there's no vested interest in the customer support rep to resolve or give a shit about your issue. That's where the problem starts.
Just to ask a question on that point, is that ignorance of the company not having a system or a process in place to do better? Is that, so are they looking at that, those companies we're talking about, are they looking at it as purely a balance sheet play and going, right, we have to offer customer support. How can we do it as cost effectively as possible? Or is it simply that they just don't understand that they've invested money over here in the purchase journey before the purchase and they're just fucking it in the post-purchase and they just can't link those two things? Like, what's your thoughts around that?
Probably a little bit of both. It's very, very hard to say like this is a customer I should invest in versus this isn't, right? Because what's tricky in our world at Jones Road, we use Gorgeous and we have a banner on the side that says how much money the customer has spent, how many orders the customer has made. Now you can make a case that if a customer has spent $500 and ordered 10 times or 5 times, this is an impactful customer and we should probably go above and beyond to fix it. Right now, if you're viewing that as like, we should do well by the customer because they're a super fan, then great. But if you're viewing it as like, they'll be a high LTV customer, they already are, right? So like, do you think they'll spend an extra $1,000? Maybe they're at the end of their customer journey. So like, maybe we should just treat them like anyone else versus like somebody that ordered twice has a potential to still have $1,000 in their bank account with us. And maybe, so when you try to like predict which is the customer you should go above and beyond, you end up getting to this like sticky place where like it's hard to know if you're getting incremental value by spending more money to resolve one person's issue versus the other person's issue. And that's like, it gets you into this like nitty gritty place where it's like, it's impossible to make a decision based on like, do you think this is good for dollars? So what we've transitioned to, and the way I started thinking about it over the last couple of years is like, is this impactful? Is going above and beyond impactful enough to make them love our brand more? And it's more of a brand play. Like if somebody is aggressive and is obnoxious and hates us already and has complained about 9 other items, I'm less excited about going above and beyond for them because like, okay, like you'll spend an extra $200. The $200 in the scheme of things is not making or breaking anything, right? Like if one customer is more excited and spends more money, that's not changing our lives. And that's very hard to look at the balance sheet and say like, oh, we went above and beyond. We spent an extra $40. Now they're going to stick around and spend an extra $350 and do the math and slice and dice it. But if we say like, this is a great way for somebody that seems really kind and they're understanding and they love us as a brand, but they're struggling to go above and beyond and send them dinner or send them flowers and they'll love our brand 10 times more and tell other people about it. Yeah, it's not trackable, but as a human, I can know that that's impactful. And I'm optimizing towards brand experiences versus like resolving somebody's order in a big way. Like, yeah, I definitely want to make sure you get your product. Yeah, I would try to expedite it. Yes, maybe I'd refund you as well because like, we want to be decent to you. But like the above and beyond is really, really hard to track unless you're thinking about it as like brand moments, right?
Yeah. And I guess And that makes complete sense. And I guess what I'm talking about is maybe not the ones where you're going to convert these people into brand enthusiasts for life, like lifelong. Well, like if you bought someone dinner or you sent them flowers, I mean, that's going to convert me into like just like a basically an advocate for your brand, right? I'm going to become a brand advocate for life, and that's cool. But I'm talking mainly about the ones, okay, so exclude shitty customers that are not based on logic and reason, because I know they must exist. In fact, I definitely know they exist.
Yes.
But the ones that are, so like me in this example, right? So I was very cool, calm and collected for, I understand e-commerce, right? I understand the inner workings of how these things happen. So I was cool about it. It didn't help though that I am vegan, and they continuously sent me, and all I order is vegan products, and they continuously sent me like meat-based products in my email marketing. I'm like, how? You're a multi-million pound company. It's just segmenting.
That's crazy.
Emails.
That's crazy.
That's a side note. Anyone who's not segmenting their audiences at least to that level, just like, what are you doing? But I thought I was a good customer, and I didn't leave a review or anything, but that's my point, right? So you've got the upside of retaining a customer potentially, and that's great, but you've also got the downside nowadays of every customer is a potential micro-influencer, or worse, they're basically hand grenades, right? So
yep.
If you piss them off, you're getting actually negative brand equity. It's like you're not even staying in the middle. You're potentially going negative because they're going to influence their circle and you know. So how do you work that out and justify? How do you even communicate that? One, value of retaining customers, but two, how do you factor in, or do you factor in the negative equity and negative brand equity of not keeping a customer happy? And I'm not talking about the pissy ones. I'm talking about real customers. Like, is there a metric, a value that you can attribute to that? Have you got a spreadsheet? Have you got a workflow? Or is it all just done on gut feeling?
Yeah, I think two things. So first of all, every single customer is somebody we try to resolve to the best of our ability, every single one, just because like, I think that your point is right. Like if one negative experience, even if somebody spent $42, that one negative experience can just not only ruin it for them, but they'll tell everyone else not to purchase. So that's just like a baseline investment that we make, is like, we want to resolve every single issue to the best of our ability. Even if somebody's really obnoxious, like we still want to resolve their issue. We might, like if they, you know, if they return every single order and they've done it 10 times, like we're probably going to clamp down because it can't make zero sense for the business, but we try our best. Now, when it comes to like, you know, frameworks and how to view these things, I think the most important thing is hiring, right? It's like you have to hire people that are deeply, deeply obsessed with making things right and treating people the way they want to be treated. Like I absolutely love making things right when a customer has a shitty experience. Like I love going above and beyond and just showing them like, hey, there's a human behind this. Like we'll fix it. And I think if you hire people that are just clocking in their hours and looking to click a canned response and send it, all the frameworks in the world can help you, because you're like, oh, hey, here's 10% off your next order because we screwed you. And they're like, well, I don't want 10% off. I just want to be validated, right? Like that's the tricky thing, right? Like I've spoken to brands that have like, customer was really frustrated and they refunded the whole order. And then the customer said like, why are you refunding me? I don't want a refund. I want the product, right? Like I never asked for a refund. They just want to be validated and heard, right? So I think that's like the number one most important thing is hiring. Like hire people that you trust, can deeply empathize with humans and do their best to make sure something's right. And then empower them, like give them the ability to spend a little bit of money if you feel like it's necessary. And yeah, I believe that gut is important. And also I believe that gut can be trained, right? Like I think that when you see the reaction to the way you act, like, you know, for every action, there's a reaction. If you see it's positive, you'll continue doing it. And if you see it didn't turn out the way you thought, you'll switch it up. So I think empowering the team and giving them the ability to, like, you think maybe we should go above and beyond for this customer. Fuck it. Try it. Let's see what happens. If they love us and they send back a mind blowing review, then we know it's working. If not, we probably wasted our money, right?
It sounds like do you know what it sounds like? It sounds like you are the human behavior element. You're the psychology team in a brand where you have commercial directors, financial directors, marketing to a degree, paid marketing maybe, who are the spreadsheet finance logical people who solve problems maybe on a more logical level, i.e. customers unhappy, give them a refund, tick the box, done. You're maybe more, it sounds like, let's just understand this behavior. This is a human. Like this, let's, each one's different. And that in itself is a skill set. And I'll give you a really good example, actually, one from the UK. So this isn't my example, and I'll probably give it too badly. But so in the UK, we have something called Eurostar, which links the UK by train to Paris, right? And other European destinations. It goes under the sea. And the UK government decided to spend upwards of £1 billion to make that journey 30 minutes faster, which is, you know, it's about a two and a bit hour journey. So to make it 30 minutes faster, okay, but they spent upwards of £1 billion. And the reasoning was they were thinking, well, this is just going to, they wanted to increase passenger happiness, right? And so they instantly went to the spreadsheet guys. And how do we do that? Well, just make it faster, obviously. But they could have spent a fraction of that cost putting massage seats in, you know, getting models to serve you free food and free drinks for the entire journey for a fractional amount. And people would probably have asked for the train to be slowed down. So there really is a divide in how you think about how you serve a customer to get ultimately, I guess, what is your KPI for you, for your customer? Is it happiness? Like what's the ultimate KPI for you?
Yeah, I think it's like, you know, Henry Ford said, if you ask customers what they wanted, they'd say faster horses, right? Like, I think it's tricky, right? Because like pretty often customers don't know what they want, right? Like they'll reach out saying like, I'm so frustrated, and they're not asking for a return. They're not asking for a replacement. And so many of the times they just want to be listened to and validated, right? Like that's my kind of guiding star is like, I know I'm a difficult customer. How would I want to be dealt with? And that's like what I try to do. And it's obviously difficult to train other people to do what I would do. But I think giving them empowering them and giving them the ability to is the most important thing. As far as like my KPIs on the CX side, like we are looking at customer satisfaction scores. We're looking at customer effort score, which is a survey on the bottom of every email that, you know, how simple and easy was it to get the issue resolved? I read a book a while back called The Effortless Experience by, I think, Matthew Dixon. And it's basically the people that have great experiences are customers that have a really frictionless way of getting their issue resolved if they face an issue. So that's, you know, we're striving to make it as simple as possible. Like, don't make somebody go back and forth 9 emails to return something. Just give them the link in the first one. And then I think when it gets more granular, we're looking at, is the CX team creating more revenue for the business? Like, obviously it's not a team that's directly correlated with like how much money are you bringing versus how much are you spending, because I think it's a brand building team. But I think, you know, even just we do shade matching. We have a quiz that does it, but we also do it through the CX team, and we have a bunch of makeup artists, professional makeup artists that have worked in retail, and that some of them are part-time makeup artists, part-time CX, and we do shade matching through email and SMS. And what we've learned is that the 3-month LTV, like I just pulled these numbers today and I thought they were absolutely insane. But our LTV from people that went through CX team shade matching is, our 90-day LTV is 70% higher than a standard customer. And our 6-month LTV is 95% higher than a standard customer. So people that are engaging with this team are spending a significantly higher amount of money. So that's a metric we can look at and say, like,
can you aside? Sorry.
Yeah.
What can you just go into that a bit more? How that,
of course.
Mental figures. What's working there?
Yeah. Well, the facts are that people that have direction of what is the part, you know, like if we face it zoomed out a little bit, the biggest objection to purchasing makeup online is, will it look good? And my hypothesis is that when people have a clear understanding of what's the best fit for them, they go into their first purchase thinking like, oh, this feels right. And they're more likely to like it because they're more excited about it from the first moment. And the relationship that they built with a person that recommended their first purchase, a big, big, big bulk of the time, they'll come back again and say like, hey, I love this, dislike that, what should I buy next? And it's essentially like shopping concierge. And they create relationships with our team, and they're just inherently, you know, closer to the brand, more excited about the products, and are more likely to love their experience versus somebody that just goes and purchases something. A, it can be, it's not the right shade. B, maybe they didn't feel like they're connected to the brand because nobody, you know, in general, I think people that engage with their CX team usually have somewhat of a higher LTV. But what we're seeing is that when we do something a little bit more transformative in terms of like the time we're investing and the relationship we're building, it's massively, massively impactful. That's my hypothesis, right? If people just come in more excited and definite about their purchase and feel closer to the brand, and even, you know, the kind of anecdotal stuff when I talk to customers and say, how was it? They say, like, you know, Aviana or Brielle or Sydney or whoever I spoke to, you know, I feel like they really tried to understand what I'm looking for, and they asked me questions, and it's, you know, it's why people love purchasing at stores that have that kind of shopping concierge. But to do that online is pretty wild.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm really interested to ask you another question about that, which is, where and how did that idea actually get implemented? Because I'm hoping, and I'm not even going to go there, but I think you guys are obviously closest to the ground, right? You are hearing the customer day in, day out. So who is better to communicate with the customer than the CX team? And what I'm starting to hear from what you're saying is, we've gone from just being customer support and trying to resolve issues to taking that information that's being fed in to you and synthesizing that into actually what can we deliver for the customer. And that is significant value, because the people that are making the decisions on how and when to implement it, this is data that if you've got someone junior on peanuts an hour, they're not even thinking this way. And this is what I really want to get out of this episode, is it's inherently built into you to think this way, I imagine. That you know, you're listening and you're thinking, how can we improve this? What could we try? But what I want to understand is, once you've got that, how do you then take that data to the people who then approve it? And how do you then build that team out within CX to deliver it?
Yeah. So the one thing I can't take credit for is I wasn't the one that had this idea. This idea started way before me. I think the reason why this idea started is when Jones Road was built, it was built to be a straightforward direct consumer brand, and we never wanted to go to retail. And because of that, we were like, shade matching is difficult. Is there a way we can make it easier? And we did before we even did the quiz, we were offering people to message us in. And originally it was a few people, right? And then it slowly started scaling and scaling and scaling. And it started being, you know, going from a few a day to hundreds a day, you know, and as it kind of grew in terms of volume, we started thinking like, is this even valuable? Like, I was bullish that it is. And I said, I bet that customers are spending more money, but how do we even pull the data? And we've been tagging these people on Gorgeous. And then we figured that we used Alloy, which is like a Zapier for e-commerce, to pull those tags from Gorgeous to Shopify. So now they're tagged in Shopify as shade matched. And now we're able to use like a, you know, an analytics tool to track LTV of customers tagged versus customers not tagged. And we're able to see these metrics. And now, you know, I got that data today and I'm like, you know, 70 to 95% higher LTV, you know, 90 to 96 months. Like, that's insane enough for us to start thinking like, how big should this team be, right? Like, how many emails should we be telling people? In how many emails should we be telling people like, hey, we offer shade matching, reach out, right? Something that traditionally wouldn't be scaled because it's too expensive and cumbersome is now a potential huge revenue driver and brand builder for us. So I think it's just being open to understanding that a CX team can be a massive money driver, and also being open to taking the chance is what I learned from this. But yeah.
Can you give us an example of what's the bare minimum that you should be offering from a CX, CS perspective as a brand? What's good and what is outstanding in your world?
Yeah, I think the bare minimum is offering support that you don't have to like call to cancel a subscription. Like, I know that some of the You know, like some of the brands in the US, you need to call between 9 to 5 to cancel a subscription. Like the beer, in my opinion, the bare minimum is giving people the ability to get an issue resolved in a normal way. What's better somewhere in the middle is offering a quick response time, with people that are in your team. Like I think that outsourcing has a time and a place. And every time I talk about not outsourcing, all the outsource people start screaming at me. Like, I think there is merit to outsourcing at certain times and places, but having, you know, if you view it as an extension of your brand, having that internal. So like when somebody reaches out, we know what's going on in the marketing because we've been in the marketing call and we know what's coming up. We know what's happening and we're just a part of the customer team. It's another touch point. I think that's the middle ground. And going above and beyond is really, you know, I had a clothing brand that I absolutely loved and spent, I don't even want to talk about how much money over the last few years. And I reached out, I've ordered so many times and I ordered a pair of shoes. And it was final sale and it was the size I always get. And it was too small. And obviously it was final sale and I totally get that, but not making an exception for a customer that spent over $1,000 in the end, and they're like, well, you can exchange it, but they didn't have any of the other sizes left. And I'm like, I don't want another t-shirt. So I'm left with this credit that I have nothing to do with. And I think that's like, you know, a rule is a rule, but I going above and beyond is viewing each, and this might sound crazy because the bar is pretty low, but viewing each customer as a holistic customer versus like setting up a bunch of like best practices and frameworks and rules, and then just like throwing them out. Like I get it, as companies scale, they need to have rules and all that stuff that makes my eyes roll, but not being able to go off script to resolve, it's I guess the other way, like being able to go off script to resolve a loyal customer's issues or make somebody's day is I think what going above and beyond is. And it, I guess it's pretty sad that that's like the best case scenario, but very few brands do that, right? Like the bar is very, very low. So
yeah. Yeah, I definitely resonate with that. So, all right, then let's say that company that you spent and you used to love is listening and they book you and say, hey, we want you to come in for a day and sort our CX team out. What are you doing? What are you implementing? What are you looking at? What are you trying to improve?
Yeah, I think this might sound pretty morbid, but the first thing I'm looking at is the team. Like I want to talk to everyone on the team and make sure they're here because they want to, not looking at CX as a way to jump into marketing or CX as a way to jump into sales. And that's the first, like the people that are actually like, we hire these senior leaders and A players and pay them a lot of money to lead a team. But then the people that are actually doing the work, if they're not doing what the company's vision is or what the leader's vision is, it's worthless. And that's why myself as a leader, like I'm in the tickets more than I should be. I'm in the DMs more than I should be, because like, this is my stuff. Like this is my work. This is what I'm excited about. This is what I love to do. And I want the team to be inspired by me and be excited about what I'm doing. And that's the hardest part. Like when you talk to these companies, like that one is a great example where I replied and said like, I've spent a crazy amount of money. Like I'm asking for an exception, and they just replied the same exact thing. Like it was copy and paste from the email before. That's less of a problem around rules as it is around people. Because even if the response was, I'm sorry, there's nothing I can do, you could have at least said like, I did my best. I asked my manager, there's nothing I can do. I totally get it. Like you can at least break the script. That's like my number one thing is like team. If the team is not fired up and inspired and excited, you already lost. And then it's process, right? It's like figuring out if the business has no money, that's one thing, but this is a business that sells out every time they drop. They do an insane amount of revenue. They're riding at the top of their industry. Like this is one of the best, most elite streetwear brands. Like the refund for a super VIP customer is not going to kill them, right? So that's like, that's a process issue. So I think it's people and process. Like those are the two biggest things. And it's not easy, right? You can't come in and be like, this is what you'll do and tomorrow everything's great. Like it's also a culture thing, right? Like if a culture, I've been to businesses where their culture is like, they don't want to spend money on this stuff and they view it as a cost center and they're going to outsource it. Like 5 years ago, I was like, I'm going to go and change it. Today, Eli today is like, fuck this. I'm going to stay very far away from that. Like, I'm not going to try to change that. The first thing that for me to take a role at any level, whether it's a full-time gig or consulting, it's like, it's not worth my energy if people aren't excited about CX. And it's really hard to change something that's been this way for, I don't know, a zillion years, right? Like it's always been that way where CX wasn't put at the top. So that's like the, you know, the number one thing, like brands have to want to, but.
I feel that, but I also, I feel that the people who ultimately end up making the decision about how they treat CX tend to be, and this is broad, but they tend to be the logical economic
yes.
You know, yep. The people not in the trenches, they're the people looking at the figures.
Spreadsheets.
And to convince them to spend more on something that they see as a necessity, that is an outgoing necessity that just 100% has downside off their bottom line. They see the returns, they see the staff costs, they see that. Like, you, it's actually, I think, more of a perception change. And what I get from you, your tweets, and all the things that I see from you specifically, I don't see from so much so in so many other areas, is that you're compartmentalizing the customer service part of the role. And yeah, okay, you have that flexibility to go above and beyond and all of those things, which are quite easy to implement. But I don't think that convinces these logical C-suite financial guys, girls, to change their mind on how they or overhaul their CX. I think what convinces them is showing the value of CX, which comes from listening, innovating, adapting, evolving, attaching it to LTV, attaching it to all the things that you are doing. So how do you do that? What are you communicating back to the leadership team about ways to drive value through CX and not just to see it as a CS, customer service call center?
I agree with you 1,000%. And what I've found in the last few years is that putting CX under marketing is usually 10 times easier, because CX under ops is usually dollars and cents equation. CX under marketing is brand, right? And I think marketing teams generally understand brand marketing. And, you know, you can hire somebody and pay them six figures to create campaigns that don't inherently drive anything on the bottom line, but essentially create a better brand, right? So I think it's usually a brand pitch for marketing leaders. And I think, you know, yeah, I think we can prove, like, this LTV case that I spoke about earlier is a perfect example of how it inherently drives our business forward, right? Like, great CX drives our business forward. But even without that, I think investing in CX is not an ROI question. It's a brand question. And when it comes to a brand question, it's like, if you as a consumer think that having great interactions with a brand makes you more likely to like the brand, humans are the same, right? Like, it's like, we are so, as marketers, we have a ton of cognitive dissonance around like how we'd feel versus how everyone else feels, right? Like, if as a consumer, you'd feel better about a brand because they treat you well, all the customers do, right? And it's like, it makes it difficult to spend the money when you don't have it, but there are plenty of brands that do an insane amount of revenue and have plenty of room on their balance sheet and still don't put CX near the top. And that's I've stopped trying to convince people to prioritize it and more show, like, you know, the brands that I work with and have the ability to be a part of, you know, like Olipop is known for their great CX. Jones Road is starting to be known for it. I mean, our scores around CX are through the roof, and hopefully in the next 6 to 12 months, people know of Jones Road as a brand that has fantastic customer experience. And that's enough for me as a customer to say, like, I'm going to put my money there, right? If I need shoes and I can buy it on Zappos or DSW and it's $2 more on Zappos, I will always go with Zappos because I love what they stand for, right? And it's like, that's my aim. My aim is obviously the product has to be great and the shipping has to be great and everything else has to be great, but I want customer experience to be a reason why people choose Jones, right? And then, yeah, my 30-year goal, right? It's like I was talking about at the beginning of the call, like, I don't have a 5-year plan. My 30-year plan is build and operate businesses that put the consumer first, full stop. And I want to prove that that's a value prop and that's a way for brands to be successful. And that's my mission, but I'm still early, so. Hope if you don't see me yet, hopefully you see me soon.
I mean, you're doing this already early. I'd say you're one of the great innovators in the space already. I don't know if that's credit to you or that you're in a space that needs to be innovated in. I think it's a bit of both. But just before we come into a lightning round, I just have a couple more questions on the data side. So you mentioned there about being known for CX. How are you benchmarking yourselves in terms of, okay, this is how we're going to measure how good we are at customer experience? And then how are you taking that measurement and then applying it against your competitors or your industry to understand where you actually sit? Like, what are you actually looking at?
Yeah, I think with most of this, it's I look at both qualitative and quantitative. On a quantitative lens, I mean, it's like NPS scores, and we ask secondary questions on, like, you know, the NPS would be on a scale of 0 through 10, how likely are you to refer Jones Road to a family or friend? And the secondary question would be, based on which of these reasons did you choose your score? And one of them would be shipping and delivery. One would be website experience, product, value, customer service. And we can segment based on, you know, are people promoting our brand because of the support or experience, or are they telling people not to shop with us based on that? So we're segmenting NPS score based on that. And NPS more broadly is something we can easily, you know, measure across other people in the industry. And I'd say the other thing that's the qualitative side that's super important to me is, like, I want to ask strangers on the street that are walking into a Sephora or walking into a Credo or whatever store they are, and say, did you hear of this brand? Like, what do you think about them? And in my craziest dream, they say, I heard they have great customer support. Or I heard that they treat their customers well, or I heard that their experience is perfect. And it's still early, but I feel like we get so much of the reviews and feedback we get are mentioning, you know, the experience they had with us. And I'm striving for that to be more and more, but that's on the qualitative side, how I would judge my own success there.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. So for the everyone listening, I think you come with an advantage to any company in that you have an established brand, personal brand in this space. And so you automatically get a voice, and that voice has already got a lot of weight behind it because of who you are. But there aren't many of you. And what I want to know is, what can companies do with managers in CX, people who are running that team, to give them a voice? Like, what questions can they be asking to try and get the best out of those employees?
Finn, what's shocking about this question is that you talk to just about every brand and they say, oh, we'd be happy to have somebody with a personal brand. But then you talk to some of the great players in this space that have worked at brands and have tried to build a personal brand, and they were told, no, you shouldn't do that podcast, or no, you shouldn't put that article, or no, you shouldn't. And there's a lot of control that comes into play here. So I think it's a toss up, right? It's like, you want to give people the ability to create and content and create a personal brand that's authentically them, but then you're going to, like, tell them how to do it and tell them what to do, what yes to do, what not to do. And that's really tricky, right? It's like, so I've seen brands that get threatened when somebody is thriving and getting a lot of press, and, you know, some of the more senior leaders aren't getting press. Like, there's a lot of, like, human behavior is so tricky. So I think that's the first thing, right? It's like, everyone likes that in theory, like, oh, I'd love to have somebody with a personal brand around what they do. But then most businesses don't really put that on a pedestal or give people the ability to, like, very few brands, like, I've read the other day on Twitter from a friend that their brand is starting to give people personal branding lessons, right? Like, that's very rare. But if you think about it, right, like, that should make sense. Like, Jones Road has, you know, has some sort of extra credit by having somebody that has a voice to talk about CX leading their team, right? Like, there's value in that. And there's value of having a fantastic growth marketer that has a brand running their team. There's value of public perception. But I think, you know, the value and how you treat it is so tricky. I think that finding a brand that is going to put that on a pedestal and give you the ability to do it is so important. Once a brand is excited about that and knows they're doing it, I think it's so important to, when we discussed this before the call, I'm an introvert, right? Like, in a traditional universe, I wouldn't be putting my thoughts and tweets and clicking tweet every day. Like, that's crazy, but I'm more passionate about the space and how much has to change and the progress we're making. And I've created, you know, a Discord with 500 people around CX to talk about it because I'm so passionate about the space. So I think passion is, once you find the passion and people that are excited about making a change, giving them the ability to start sharing becomes a whole lot simpler. And sometimes it's like, I found great CX people that never shared because they never had the opportunity to. So I phoned a friend and said, like, hey, you're recording podcasts. You want to get this person on. They're a great leader in this space, but never share anything. So it's on us as well, like people that have a voice to uplift other people. And then businesses to empower, like everything else, the more business empowers, the more growth opportunity people and businesses have. But yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for sure. And that was kind of a bonus answer for me because I maybe didn't frame the question right, but I get it. And I think being able to empower your employees and allow them to have a voice and, you know, you're building your brand here, but you're also building the company you work for, right? This is going to go out to people and
good for everyone.
Yeah, it's good for everyone. Like, and it's not like you're coming across negatively. So I don't really see where that would be an issue, but just to rewind, the point I was making was that you have a voice in your company because of who you are, not necessarily just because of that, but you certainly have a lot of weight behind that because of who you are. There are a lot of companies out there who just have a manager doing, you know, part, maybe even not their whole job role is CX. So what I wanted to know is, what advice would you give to a leadership team? What questions should they be asking that person who's in charge of CX to try and get them to be thinking like you think, to get the best out of them? What should they be saying you need to focus on? Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, if I understood your question, it's like, how do people get their CX leaders to think differently and think more forward about CX? And I think the answer to that is that challenging best practices is always my favorite. Like, so many people, you know, I when I was interviewing for the role at Jones Road, Bobby asked me, she said, the other person I'm interviewing has a decade plus experience at a very luxury women's clothing brand. And you are a dude that never wore makeup and has no experience in this space. Why should I hire you? And I said, frankly, it sounds like this other person has fantastic experience. You might want to hire them. The reason why you would hire me is because you do things differently. That's how you got to where you are. And I will most definitely do things differently as well. So if you want to go off the beaten path and try something new, I had no experience in soda or luggage or anything else when I started. And I love learning about new spaces and doing things differently. And I think that my biggest fear is hiring somebody that has a decade of experience doing the same exact thing at four different companies, because that's going to get you the same thing that they saw. And that might not be a bad thing. Like, the company that this other person worked at was awesome. But that's not us, right? Like, we want to do things differently. And I think that's my number one thing, is like, challenge people to do things differently. Just because you did this at your last role doesn't mean you should be doing it here. And go back to kind of first principles, like what is good CX? Not how many emails should you send in a day? Like, let's start from foundationals, right? Like, what is great CX? What is terrible CX? How do we make sure not to deliver bad CX? How do we upgrade our current customer experience? I think that's like the biggest challenge that I like to give people, is like, just forget everything you've learned and let's start again.
Yeah, amazing. And that's, just a perfect answer really to that question.
Thank
There's
you.
No excuse for poor CX anymore, full stop. You've been really generous with your time, so I am going to cut the lightning round down a little bit and jump into it now, if that's okay. So we've just got a few
of course
here, if I can find it. Can't find them, but I know them well enough. So the first question is, if you weren't doing this, what do you think you'd be doing?
Oh God, I love traveling. I have a few dream roles, some of which I might still get to in my life, but one of the dream roles I had was writing Points and Miles blog content. I love flying and I love seeing new places. And there's a site called The Points Guy, which recently launched in the UK. And I was like, what a dream. Imagine flying first class and writing about it and taking photos. So that would be a dream role.
Hey, you've just led me straight into one of our sponsors, American Express. If anyone needs a gold card, corporate card, platinum card,
I can help with that pitch.
Points.
I can help with that pitch. Most of my travel has been, I mean, all of my travel has been for free with Points and Miles. So I have the Amex Platinum, which I absolutely love, and four other Amex cards. My wife has four cards as well. And we are devout Amex cardholders and absolutely love the Centurion lounges and the benefits and the perks. And Amex is my favorite brand ever. So There you
done,
go.
You've done enough, bro. We'll hook you up with some straight into the account.
There you go.
So your account details after this, and I'll send it along to my contact in the States. Awesome. So yeah, cool. And you can tell that you have a passion for writing because your threads are just so good. So do check them out on Twitter primarily. But do you put them anywhere else?
I'm a little bit of a LinkedIn poster, but Twitter is really my first home.
Yeah, for sure. How much money is enough money for you to do your passion projects in the bank? I need a number.
Mm. Wow. I'd say, I'd say 10 million, which sounds extreme, but I grew up in a family that had a lot of money and lost it all. So I'm like very, very obsessed with being financially stable. So I probably have a higher number than most, but
you'll find out. You'll find out.
Yeah.
This is a question from our sponsor, which is Rewind. How do you safeguard your store in terms of how do you protect it? Do you protect it at all, or do you just trust Shopify to do that for you?
Oh, gosh. This is probably a much better question for Cody. I'm probably the wrong person to ask.
Okay, I'll tell you what would be a better question. How would your CX stats be affected if your store went down for 4 hours?
That would not be good. That would be chaos. So I wouldn't like that. Yeah.
Okay, cool. I'll ask you one more question then. What do you think the biggest takeaway that you've learned so far is about CX in terms of, yeah, just that?
I love that. Being a person, I think the something I've been thinking about so much is cognitive dissonance that marketers and e-commerce players have in general, right? Where we think of business as one way, but we would absolutely hate if a business would do it to us. And that goes from our non-existent exceptions on returns to the amount of email we send, just like you were talking about with your vegan versus non-vegan, right? Like we just spray and pray instead of segmentation. I think it's just across every marketing piece of the business, thinking about would this be something we'd like before doing it is my biggest learning in this space. And it's like, whenever I have a doubt, like, how should I handle this? I think if I was the consumer, how would I like this to be handled? And the answer is not like, oh, give them a full refund and give them a week dinner, right? Like that's not the answer. The answer is like within the realm of reality, what would I expect a brand to do? And it's usually just a very straightforward, non-canned response apology, right? But that's something I think about nonstop. It's like, I hate the dissonance, right? It's like, if I wouldn't like this, why am I doing it?
Dude, it has been a pleasure and just such an experience for me.
Thank you so much, man.
Everyone follow Eli on Twitter, and maybe one day he'll do some kind of playbook or something that you can grab off him if that doesn't already exist. Have you got a playbook or anything like that?
Not yet. Maybe someday.
Awesome. All right, thank you so much.
Thank you, Finn.
The fact that you're still here at the end of this episode tells me that, one, you must have enjoyed it, and two, you're probably as big of an e-commerce geek as I am. Thank you for sticking around, and I just want to give a special thanks to Rewind, Clearco and Vixer for sponsoring this episode. You can find more information and the offers that are associated with those companies in the show notes below. Please also, if you haven't already, go to ecom.gold and subscribe to Gold Club. You'll get alerts about upcoming episodes. You'll get extra content like playbooks from each of the people and guests that we have on the show. And you'll also get access to some of the exclusive content that we have coming up. And finally, do share the show with your friends. Give us a review. It really helps us to build our audience. I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day. Take it easy, and we'll see you.